Okay, Brian, welcome back. You're a regular every 2 weeks. We haven't finished even your first sojourn foray into the Rare Tom Fisher Rare Book Library with the McLuhan Library. So you can pick up something you want to talk about from the notes.
Sure. Well, there was one thing that was delightful to find was I was looking at the letters of Ezra Pound, and I was looking at those letters because I was hoping that there would perhaps be some sort of note or something in Pound that McLuhan underlined perhaps somewhere that would relate back to the, I want to say famous, I wish they were famous, maybe someday they'll be the famous letters of McLuhan to Pound where he's talking about secret societies and how he's just discovered to his horror how they have their fingerprints all over the art and et cetera.
I just want to say, Brian, at these, if that is true that he discovered them, then that's when he's writing to Pound in 51 and 52. He discovered that with Don Thiel, who's only 23, 24. So Don Thiel had some great stories to tell about that period, you know, as he watched Marshall be shocked. Okay, I just wanted to say that.
Cool. Yeah, the unfortunately, looking in the letters of Pound, there was basically a bust for that subject. But I found I wasn't... Not only did I look at the book itself, but there was this was also one of the books that had some other items removed, pulled out of between the pages. And there were some, among them were some very small little cue card type things where he was, it seemed to be taking notes on another book, and his handwriting is sometimes really atrocious, but and there was also an abbreviation in there, but I gathered that this other book he was looking at was called Scholarship in America 1900 something.
Yeah.
But one of his little handwritten notes that was on there contained a passage that I totally recognized from somewhere in the literary criticism of Marshall McLuhan, where he's saying this was, this might be a little bit different from what ended up being published, but this was what was written on one of the handwritten cue cards. It says, "Public can't credit artist with scholarship, science, or philosophy. Romantic idea that artist is a goose who lays unwittingly golden eggs for others. Brackets, scandal of Eliot's erudition, must be hushed up so egg can be stolen with clear conscience."
Now, that is so timely for me because I'm reading the unpublished manuscript of Don Thiel called The Ecology of Sense.
Right.
And I read it last week or two ago, and then I'm rereading it and noticing the fine details. I find if I reread something, I really understand it. And that quote... is exactly what Don's thesis is about, to show that the artist was a philosopher, theorist, and should be included, and it leads to the great theorizing and scientific probing by James Joyce. That's his main grounds, Finnegan's Wake, but he relates it to Paul Klee and Dadaist and Surrealist and everybody that's relevant, Moholy Nagy, a few other guys, Schoenberg, across the board, all the arts and sciences. And that must be what he learned from McLuhan, because he, when he did Meeting His Rearview Mirror in 71, he was blasting McLuhan in different aspects, but he said bless McLuhan for highlighting the importance of the artist in the world of thought or philosophy or science or whatever. And Don makes a beautiful case to show how poetic productions, which now are anything pretty well, are necessary for the evolution of humans. And the word, the conversation, the talk of human beings is a big factor. As McLuhan would say, the greatest art form is human conversation. So I find it timely that you're quoting that. Is this quote in your notes, the extended notes you sent me October 25th? Do you have that one?
I did include that one in there. Because I know that I recognize that from, I've read basically pretty much word for word. I know I read the same thing somewhere in his, I guess it's the literary criticism of Marshall McLuhan, that you know, that little, I assume that I stumbled across the original place where he first, you know, articulated that to himself or first thought of that and then later included it in a published essay or something, which is always, it's always a little geeky thrill to come across something like that.
Yeah. You know, now, this is in that book, 1900 Criticism book?
Yeah, it was, well, it was on a separate, it was on its own little cue card. There was a small stack, there was like six or seven of these little cue card size slips of paper that were tucked into the letters of Ezra Pound. And I say this other book because these little cue card slips of paper had something other, like written in the top left corner, it said, SCH America 1900, something about that. Like I don't know. So it seemed like he was taking notes on a different book,
right?
But or notes for something. Maybe he was reviewing a book called that and compiling notes for that. I don't know. But
it is one of those notes that has this quote about the artist is not a philosopher. That is in one of those, or just with those book notes.
No, it's on one of those little slips of paper.
Okay.
That was
right.
Tucked in with the letters of Ezra Pound.
Right. Now, what, it's interesting. I was wondering how to begin to talk about Thiel. Thiel's beef, he's taken the title of The Ecology of Sense from Gregory Bateson's famous book in the 70s, Steps to an Ecology of Mind. And Thiel thinks that mind will distract people, so he wants to say, make it an ecology of sense, steps to an ecology of sense. And what he felt is that McLuhan was so correct to talk about how the new media environments were the new art forms. But in the Madison Avenue simplification of McLuhan's message, people missed an important part of McLuhanism, or what McLuhan wanted to teach, was that he got it from all these artists and thinkers back and critics back in 1910, 20, 30. That's where he got it from. And it got lost in the fad of McLuhanism. So Don felt he had to retrace basically some messages, basic messages of McLuhan, and emphasize everybody that contributed, especially James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, and Pound, and those guys, and do it across the arts, and move over to Eisenstein, the great Soviet filmmaker, or maybe you say Russian filmmaker now. And he wanted to correct the record, get people back on track so that they could get to an understanding of Finnegan's Wake, which he felt was way more important than understanding McLuhan. McLuhan was a means to getting to the Wake, but the Wake, its contribution to everything, and all the theorists and the professional scientists of communication theory did not know that many of their ideas came from Joyce. So that's his agenda. And that book was written, that manuscript was written probably 30 years ago. And then he had a chance to do a bigger version in 1995 called The Joyce Era. It's called Beyond the Word, subtitled The Joyce Era. So he makes a big deal out of it. But it's a great education on what Marshall taught in his courses. You know, Don is really good at replaying and adding to what Marshall taught. So that rests. Have you ever read any Thiel books?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I read James Joyce's Techno-Poetics as well as the I didn't read the original, the early Medium is the Rearview Mirror book, but I read the Virtual Marshall McLuhan.
Right, right. Well, the
Virtual Marshall McLuhan and James Joyce's Techno-Poetics.
Can you remember what point you might have learned that stands out from it?
The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, one of the main points of that book, or sub-themes of that book, was about how all of the themes that you emphasize about McLuhan are kind of the potent ones. Like, it seems like it's not for nothing that the book actually begins at the very first sentence of the book in the acknowledgments is saying that this book arose out of a number of serendipitous encounters with Robert Dobbs, because,
right.
You know, the way he fleshes out not only the idea that that McLuhan's suspicion of or McLuhan's conviction of the deep influence of secret societies had a big influence on his his whole thought, as well as particularly his shift in style from Mechanical Bride to afterwards. And I noticed lately that Philip Marchand actually does a pretty good job of, he doesn't just mention it in passing, but in his biography from 89, there's a good couple of pages where he not only quotes from those letters to Pound, but also quotes the part about says that McLuhan felt he had been a fool in his earlier writings,
yeah.
That there was that epiphany was not just some sort of private thing, that it was fundamentally related to his shift in style, that it wasn't just a matter of the difference from Mechanical Bride to afterwards wasn't just a matter of an enlarging of the scope of his scholarly interest in all the explorations stuff, but fundamentally also was dictated by this idea that I need to be more aware of what's going on, of how the game is played, and I need to either play the game or figure out a way to kind of subtly subvert the game.
Yeah. I found in this manuscript, Ecology of Sense, I'm glad I acquired it when I acquired Don Thiel's, a chunk of his archives, that was in there, I didn't know it existed, and he puts it in order of why he brings in Kenneth Burke, Bateson, precursors to McLuhan, Alexander Pope, and other people, Paul Valéry, the critic. All these people are laid out properly in sequence through the early chapters, and then culminating in a couple of chapters on Finnegan's Wake before he gets into modern films like Kubrick's, 2001. He did Machavesky, I don't know how you say his name, Machavesyev, W.R., The Mysteries of the Organism, and Sweet Movie. And he does Orson Welles, and he does Fellini's 8.5, and they're pretty interesting. He does cover those movies in his later books, but he puts it in order so you understand the aesthetic point he makes. And you may not get it if you do Beyond the Word in 95, that major text, because it's sort of scattered purposely and doesn't lay it out sequentially. So that's the value of this manuscript. So I hope to make it available at some point someday to people. Okay, so that's a good beginning
yeah,
point.
Lots of good points in the field. I mean, the other one that seems to point to you was this idea. There was a whole chapter in The Virtual Marshall McLuhan about McLuhan being that the whole French postmodern scene was much more of a thing happening in McLuhan's wake than is generally recognized.
Right.
That it's difficult to, it can be difficult to trace the kind of direct inspiration, but that even if there isn't so much of a direct inspiration, that still the climate of thought that arose there and the styles of thought and the new subjects were that basically it's easy to overemphasize how radically new they were for the French, because in a lot of ways they were just sort of filling out areas, territories that McLuhan had initially opened up.
Yeah, and I do that in detail in this long essay on all the schools of media ecology that's on the McLuhan of Maui website under publications. What's interesting in the medium is that, no, in the Virtual Marshall McLuhan book, there's an appendix by Ted Carpenter, who did that great speech last week. If you didn't hear it, you got to hear it. It's the only time I ever heard Carpenter. He's incredible, really important. You can see why he claims he wrote half of Understanding Media. You know, he co-wrote it.
Last week, you hang on the show on Payday last week?
Yeah, on Payday, maybe.
Yeah,
last week or the week before, we played a long talk by Ted Carpenter given at Fordham in 68, and it's awesome the way his mind works in relation to McLuhanism. So if you haven't heard that, you know, go check it out. It's in the later hours, you know, hour 12 or 10 or something. I could look it up later, email it to you. But the let's see, I was going to say Carpenter. Oh, yeah, in his appendix in Don Thiel's, and that's T-H-E-A-L-L, T-H-E-A-L-L. In his book on McLuhan, came out in 2001, he talks, being the editor of the Explorations, the journal he and McLuhan and Don Thiel started, and became famous in the 50s. He says that Roland Barthes and Derrida and a lot of those guys, the post-structuralist, post-modernist guys of the French world, French theory, were subscribers to explorations. Did you know that?
Yeah.
So that's pretty good evidence right there of the influence of McLuhan. Now, Don Thiel does a really good job of showing the influence of those guys through showing what Ezra Pound and Eisenstein and Joyce and these people did in their theory and their literary criticism and this and that to show how they anticipated the themes of Derrida and Barthes, especially James Joyce.
This whole thing about the artist or the poet in particular as has to be portrayed as a goose that lays unwittingly golden eggs that, you know, the philosopher or the critic has, you know, kind of discovers these things that, this implication that, like, well, the artist, the poet was clearly just sort of, they just picked this line out of their head randomly. They looked it up in their gut somehow, as Colbert would say, but then it turns out that it's actually very brilliant if you think about it or something, with this idea that they didn't actually think about it somehow. Yeah, it's very important. It gets to this whole, like, there's a lot of very bad pigeonholing of what it speaks to this whole degraded idea of what the artist is and their limitations, and it ties into the idea that people have that what artists do is express themselves or express their emotions, and that's what an artist does, and that the value of it is if you can see a reflection of your own. You see a reflection of your own emotion in what they expressed, and then that, you know, consoles you on your journey through life or something, and that's basically as good as it gets as far as artists. Like, the idea that they are philosophers, and that better than philosophers, because they're not hindered by the basic visual bias of having to pound out every idea into a over-prosed, you know,
mathematics
in sheet. Yeah.
Okay, let me add to that. Thiel says that the new electric environments of the 100 years ago forced the philosophers and left hemisphere dialecticians to ask new questions. And so they were still working within the inherited themes and topics, but they had new questions about all these old categorical disciplines. But Thiel says that what the artist was dealing with was the effect of the new media on communication itself, including their own arts, what they were doing, painting, sculpture, music, dance. So they tuned into the present and how communication itself was affected, while the philosophers and scientists were still worried about content and saying, well, we have to adjust our content, still not even thinking about communication theory. We got to state new ideas differently because our present categories are obsolesced by the new media and what they seem to be doing to people. So that's the difference. And then society inherited this idea that scientists were technical geeks and just making stuff, and the artists were dealing with high level emotions or archetypes. And the two of them being brought together, the engineer and the poet or critic. Was not thought of. But the big hero 100 years ago in the art world was Leonardo da Vinci, because he was an engineer and a thinker and a poet. So that is what they started to realize. And that's why it ended up Joyce saying, I'm the greatest engineer that ever lived. And you have to figure out why he says that. It's not an empty statement. It's not frivolous. And it leads to McLuhan saying that Joyce dealt with problems way more relevant to our time than Einstein did. He put Einstein in the back room. So most people wouldn't believe that, wouldn't understand that. That's the important point of training perception of what we're offering here. We're showing you the people that you never heard of, never read, and they will do you well and will prepare you for ION. As a matter of fact, I want to read this, just looking in Chapter 8 of The Ecology of Sense, which is about this filmmaker, Yugoslav filmmaker Makavejev, Makavejev, Dusan Makavejev. It's called W.R. for Wilhelm Reich, W.R. Mysteries of the Organism. Well, in that chapter, Don's last sentence is, last couple of sentences, talking about Machiavellev, who made these movies in the 70s. Machiavellev, who is a popular culture buff, thankful to Popeye and Mickey Mouse, folk songs and kitsch ads, counterculture figures and journalistic issues, demonstrates a similar awareness of the reciprocity of media in the way the books of and about Reich, Wilhelm Reich, as well as all these phenomena, act in and on his film. There's many meta levels in this film. In being appropriated into film, these media are potentially transformed in their own relations outside the film as well. I'll do that again. In being appropriated into film, the reciprocity of these media are potentially transformed in their own relations outside the film as well. That means for their own realms where they work, besides being content or styles or methods in the film. And then Don says, in this process of change, man's ability, well, it's changed to people's ability to act, is liberated in the new levels of awareness of how to communicate that arise from the interplay between order and disorder. So let's break that down. You have the interplay between order and disorder going on all the time, and it causes apparent change. Well, people's ability to act is liberated when they have new levels of awareness of how to communicate, which is exactly what we've been claiming here and Ian's been claiming here on Payday. We're here to, you don't talk right, you don't speak right, we want to teach you how to talk. And this is a complex statement by Theo, but he's saying what we're saying. In this process of change, Ionette's ability to act is liberated. To act means not react, but to act and probe is liberated in the new levels of awareness of how to communicate that are brought in by new arts that arise from the interplay between order and disorder. So that's just a pretty good sentence written 40 years ago. And I find all kinds of sentences in Theo that communicate our situation here. Let's go on to, if you have nothing to say about that or more, great, but do you want to go on to another quote?
That's a pretty good seeing into another thing that I was kind of related to what I was talking about in a previous time when going deep into the idea of McLuhan's shorthand, the CM, C/M versus C-M for center with margins versus center everywhere, margins nowhere, or margins up or center nowhere or something. That idea of how it's kind of the final piece to be put on top of it. I was talking about in terms of notes that he had made in in Velikovsky, who was talking about how the whole paradigm of stability, or I guess order versus disorder, the whole paradigm of order being in the solar system, of order being the norm and disorder being these exceptions, or the idea that you can model the solar system based on that it's fundamental, even though it doesn't actually match these mathematical models, you can basically say that, well, really it does match them, and all of the differences are negligible and caused by, you know, some imperfection, but that really they are obeying these laws, even if they don't really match up. And the way that paradigm of stability is really important to the idea of the Darwinism and there being enough time for the particular type of evolution. The idea also of center margin relating to fields of study, and that you've got that you can just specialize in one thing versus Fuller being a generalist, and that McLuhan had found a part in Fuller where he says that he set out to be a comprehensivist as opposed to a specialist by being in the Navy and going into the Navy, that they were the only field in the entire world that actually had, that you could actually go and study how to try to be a comprehensivist. And we talked about that a little bit, but another Fuller quote that relates to this whole center margin thing, that McLuhan did put a CM note beside is in Fuller's Synergetics, where he is taking special note of the quote, where right near the beginning of Synergetics, where Fuller's talking about viruses, and McLuhan has underlined a few phrases. No physical threshold does in fact exist between animate and inanimate, and also no life per se has been isolated. And McLuhan underlined those phrases and put a C/M beside it. So, I mean, that it really, his note could have gone either way. I mean, the C/M seems to be indicating the viewpoint that Fuller is kind of acting against. Writing against.
Well, center-M means centers, no centers and no margins, right? Or centers
right.
Everywhere, right? And he's saying that in relation to Buckminster Fuller's statement that there's no real division between the animate and the inanimate. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that when you look really closely at the action of viruses and kind of like what is the line between life and non-life, living chemistry and non-living chemistry, that the way that viruses occupy this kind of gray zone really demonstrates that there is no hard and fast division. There is no really strong, that the idea of there being a clear center/margin where life is the center and then the disorder of non-life is in the margins, that difference.
What McLuhan is doing there is showing the effect of the new audile tactile electric environment, so that visual definition of visual separateness and categorization and classification, which ran the show for a couple hundred years, was not viable, and Fuller was one of the first thinkers to note that. It was happening in the arts, too. Even the problem, what's high art and what's low art, is what Joyce and those guys are doing. The visual demarcations of that's that there and this is over there are blurring, and so he's saying that Fuller's idea, which for many people might be a revolutionary idea when they read it, when Synergetics came out, I don't know, 1980 or late 70s, Marshall's saying, oh, that's just an effect of the electric environment. We dim down our visual acuity and start to get into the audio tactile blur. So I think that's why he's saying this is a normal idea under centers everywhere, margins nowhere conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you knew that, right? What I'm saying, you understood that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the, that it's, yeah, and that it's part of the new, especially tying into this idea that in order to kind of look closely enough at this stuff to really determine that there is no hard and fast line, it's part of this, like what I was saying before, that quantum physics, it would probably help understand if we referred to quantum physics as electric physics.
Yeah.
Because it's the physics that comes from using electric tools to probe reality rather than just non-electric ones.
Right.
And that, you know, with just a basic microscope, with the kind of the limits of a microscope, you can't necessarily look that closely at things, and that it's more when we get into this kind of hardcore electro scan. The proper phrase is not coming to mind right now, where they're getting the molecular scanning down to a really finely resolved level, that's when we kind of start to truly realize that the virus is kind of firmly straddling the line between what we thought was animate and inanimate. What do we mean by animate?
Right. Now, I want to add to that, this is where the line between life and death started to blur 100 years ago, and the interest in the occult and channeling and seances, it comes in as a fad. The people are becoming aware of the lack of division by default, because electric media are making them start to not be so visually defined. And we see that ION completes that process, or takes it even further about there's no even sequence of events going on. Your life never had a beginning, never had an ending, and death is not anything separate from it. There is no death. So it's interesting to look at all kinds of fields and see the common point here. And the common point is the effect that the electric media, this is McLuhan's breakthrough, the electric media affected all forms of knowledge. It affected what people talked about and how they talked and all the arts that were expressions of talking and then the sciences. And that seems the most useful idea in a world of information overload. When you have this notion, the medium is a message, you can bypass a lot of triviality when you're thinking seriously, you know, when you get into a mood of trying to figure out what's what.
Absolutely. Because, you're looking for, you know, information overload equals pattern recognition is the old phrase, I think. And when you get to the what's the deepest, most useful kind of pattern recognition, it comes down to this, we go through this big, it's like what is the core pattern of a kind of a cultural mood? Because it's not just about new discoveries. It's about what discoveries
communicate,
resonate.
What they communicate. What's the effect of the environment? So let me bring in an artist to see if she has anything to add to this. So this is Little Sarah. Okay, Little Sarah, have you got something that you're thinking as you listen to us? I guess you didn't expect to be called on. Let's go to Michael, her buddy. Michael, you have any thoughts about this? What's the matter with you two? What? Go ahead, Sarah. Well, you give them an opportunity to speak, and they don't even show up. Okay, let's see who else. I'll leave their lines open so they get their act together. I don't know who this is. This is somebody in British Columbia, area code 778. You want to introduce yourself? 778-356, British Columbia. There's a cat meow. Nothing? I don't know who this is. Maybe they have something to say. 774-254, you want to say something? Well, remember, if you don't say anything, you don't get talked to ions. Okay.
Not right now. I have nothing to say.
Doesn't matter. You got to say something, or you won't be able to speak later. Better take advantage of this.
You caught me putting my dishes away.
Right. Well, ask about dishwashing. You know. How's that relate to art?
Hey, me too. I'm moving dishes around.
What'd you say, Brian?
I'm just saying I'm moving dishes around, too.
Yeah, see? Now, Beefheart used to say, listen to his albums while sweeping the floor or doing the dishes. That's what this background, the old arts are for, background music, or maybe they can become cliche probes. But this dishwashing is a common metaphor in art for what artists do. What do you think of that? Are you Joseph or Garan?
No, Garan.
Garan. So, you know, make up some words.
The washing the dishes. The artist.
That's right. You're being the artist.
So all the glasses have to be together in order. Chaos.
You're making order out of chaos, out of disorder.
To keep the wife happy.
Do you have a wife? You never indicated that when we ran around up Cambridge, Maryland. All that crazy stuff we did. I didn't know you were married.
That was a different world.
He was in a different world, Brian. He used that alibi. Okay. So, Brian, I will mute Garand. You can go on to the next point, Brian, that draws your attention. We'll see if anybody is inspired to say anything.
Let's see. Well, the thing before about what did I get out of Thiel's book?
Yes.
The other one, it's certainly very, I mean, there's a lot of books that are written where there's very thin excuse to really write a whole book about a subject, but James Joyce's Technopoetics is a very rich one. It would be rich anyway, even if it wasn't for, apparently, it really needed to be written, because there was a popular sense that, like, he quoted someone actually saying someone was able to tell themselves and get away with saying, as if it made sense, that Joyce ignored technology. somehow was, like, not interested in it or something, that maybe somehow people have run with the idea of, maybe that's what it, when people think of the basic insight of Ulysses and the trick of Ulysses as being this overlaying of the mythical, the old mythical Homer cycle happening in the day in Dublin, that maybe people don't really notice that, well, what is the difference between back in Homer's time and the time now? It's like, are you just so hypnotized by the similarities he's drawing that you don't notice, like, well, what's the difference? Now we have these different technologies that we're swimming in and stuff. And even if it was just that by overlaying the common mythical experience of that person having their life in Dublin in 1904, is expressing the same archetypes as high art back then in their daily life, that, you know, I mean, obviously it's taking place. I mean, there's a whole new office thing, and I don't know, it's incredible that people were able to say with a straight face that James Joyce somehow ignored technology. So the James Joyce's Technopoetics book did a really good job of not only showing, you know, many, many, many examples of where in Joyce's writing he's not only dealing with technology in terms of setting certain aspects of Ulysses here and there and that kind of thing, but also using terminology, and especially in Finnegan's Wake, there's a lot of kind of technic, jargony, kind of technological sort of language,
yeah.
But that not only is he doing that, but also he's explicitly trying to retrieve this idea of the artist as being a kind of an engineer.
Yeah. Okay, this, the thing about Ulysses, the striking thing for the average reader was, oh, gee, he's sort of saying Dublin is like Greek culture or Homer time. And, yeah, then maybe overland, thinking there's a repeat of archetypes. But what they miss is that Joyce was showing that Dublin in 1904 retrieved the odd-out tactile sensibility of the pre-literate Homer period. So Homeric sensibility was happening across the planet in 1904. That's the real reason why, one of the better reasons to understand why Joyce made the parallel. So when T.S. Eliot says, oh, this is the mythic method, mythic parallels, that may not be exactly what Joyce was doing. It was a more technical example of the content of the century and then what resonates with it. So that's something that's not said about Ulysses, that he's saying Dublin, here's a daily life in Dublin, but it's retrieving as a new figure the old archetype of Greek Homeric sensibility. And right. that's really acted out by the Beatniks later with their oral ranting. You know what I mean? In the 50s and 60s, the Beatniks, Ginsberg shocks everybody with Howl by just ranting on for a long time in that famous performance in San Francisco. And
yeah,
it's by the time of oral
bias of a poet, a more oral community creating rather than a book writing and reading.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see that's, of course, anticipated by the oral rant of Finnegan's Wake, which then becomes all media and dreams and all kinds of things. Now, I got a couple people here. Let's just see if Corbin has something to say sensibly to this discussion. If not, I'll mute him. Okay, Corbin.
What's going on, Bob? Yeah, I'm listening
Nothing up. You.
What?
You. Go ahead.
Oi, yes. What's the apps, man? How are you?
We're not interested in how I am or how you are. Are you have something to say to what we're talking about? Have you been listening?
Yes, I've been listening. And let me see. Order, disorder. Order, disorder. Are you familiar with a little band known as System of a Down? Okay, they have a song called Toxicity. Something else has crossed my path in the audio sensorial position this week. Apparently, there's a public radio James Joyce exposition that has to do with a thing called The Dead. Are you familiar with this?
Well, The Dead is a story, the last story in The Dubliners, and it was made into a movie with Angela Houston. Maybe it was made by her father. Does that sound familiar, Brian? That movie,
I don't know if that's a movie, but yeah.
Well, I'm saying it's actually James Joyce's voice, his audio sensorial voice, without using a medium. Now, keep in mind, Finnegan's Wake was essentially when James Joyce had exiled himself from his homeland of Ireland.
He did that with Portrait of the Artist. He exiled himself in 1904 when he was 22.
Oh, 1904, a very interesting year that you should mention that. 1904.
Yeah, that's a Crowley thing. But listen to this. No. I'm going to mute you just to say a sentence. So he goes back to Ireland in 1909 to open a chain of movie theaters, and it doesn't work. And then he never really returns to Ireland, as far as I know, again. So, yes, I've unmuted you, Corbin. Stay on the topic here. The Dead is the last story, 15 stories, called The Dubliners. And it is a replay of Ovid's Metamorphoses, which had 15 stories, apparently. Just like Ulysses is mimed in Ulysses, The Dubliners, which was a early epic, redoes Ovid. Yeah, go ahead.
Bob, have you actually been to Dublin, spent any time there?
I did on August 22nd or something in August. First time I ever been to Dublin was in August.
Well, you're aware that obviously that was one of my first, oh gracious, missions of the Diana thing. But regardless,
Corbin for the people, I will mute you again. Corbin for everybody was in Dublin, that'd be August 31st or so, 1997, when Princess Diana apparently transitioned. Corbin called me, communicated with me by phone, to saying that he was part of that mixture. Now, unmute Corbin. But did I get it right, Corbin?
Yeah, you got it. And more or less, there's a really very nice street in downtown Dublin. There's the Molly Malone statue. Is Molly Malone resonant with you on any level tonight? Why am I having Molly Malone?
No. No.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's very fine. Other than that, disorder. Disorder. Are you familiar with this band, System of a Down?
Do you know that band, Brian?
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with them. I mean, I was active when I was in high school. I was into kind of industrial sort of music, but they weren't really my particular cup of tea, but I was familiar with them somewhat.
Okay, so they go back to 30 years. Okay, I unmuted you again, Corbin. What do you have to say about them?
Well, you keep saying disorder, and that's the main theme of the one song called Toxicity. Now, there's been a very interesting, there's so many events going on. Oh, gracious. Now, we're familiar that Walmart's the biggest employer in the United States. Craig, do you have anything to say on their states, their status?
The history we got from Ion on Walmart is that was set up by the Chinese back in the 60s or 70s, whenever he started. Down there in Arkansas, and that's why the Hillary Clintons were inevitable to be in the White House, because their law firm was involved with the setting up of Walmart to be the agency of the Chinese elite, financial elite, and in their taking over the American economy as a result of Nixon going to China in 1971. Nixon didn't go there and open China to the Western world. Nixon went there with hat in hand and then bankrupt and said, we'll give you the United States. What do you want? So they said, we want to do the general store thing, whatever you call those stores, and we're going to do it through Mr. Walton. And very involved in that was Hillary Clinton's father, and very involved in those negotiations. That's what put Hillary in there as on the path to some kind of rearview mirror life in the White House. So, yes, that's what I know about the Waltons.
Okay, so what's happened here, essentially, there are no Walmarts where I live in Los Angeles. There are three of them. They built one downtown. Before it was open, they had riots, essentially, saying, look, we don't want a company that's already taken over the United States from coast to coast, doesn't pay any benefits, insurance, retirement policies, all the above. And so nonetheless, they opened one of these big grandiose stores that people are so accustomed to. Everything has become homogenized. I think, what is it, Zappa's, Denny Wally's book, The Uns, no commercial potential, correct? And he's used the quote that the United States has become one big snot mold from coast to coast of homogeny. More or less. And so anyway, if you drive outside of where I'm located in the houses of hounds, nonetheless, before they opened the store up, they already started rioting. Once they opened the store, they already knew they weren't going to pay these people benefits or wages of any substantial interest. So now the store has been open for a little over 16 months. They recently, in the last 14 days, had police in riot gear with rubber bullets. Everybody was the workers, the patrons, everybody was rioting downtown. And I just saw two of these AWACS things on Friday, you know, the big B-52s with the cylinder type, two cylinder type things on top. AWACS things flying within about, oh, I would say about 100 meters, 50 to 100 meters above the city. I was like, oh my God, goodness, this is martial law. And all the right-wing Republicans have been saying, oh, yeah, Obama's going to stop everything, and he's going to take on another term and declare martial law and all this paranoia. And I'm like, and nobody was seeing this. It was like I didn't even have to will myself to turn invisible, and everybody just went about their day as, oh, ho-hum, another day. I'm like, you are being overtaken. You are now in, Bob, you're not in control anymore.
You got to get on the drops, Corbin. You got to get on the drops and relax. I appreciate the news story. I didn't know anything about it, but I'm not paying much attention. But just to hold it, Corbin, I want to bring a few other people in here to see if they want to address Brian. Brian, you're still there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see what 213, because I have made the statement, if you do not talk before Ion comes, you don't get to talk to Ion. You're going to have to create something. So, 213, you'd like to speak, 213-255.
Hey, it's me, Bob. It's Leon.
Who is it?
Leon.
Oh, okay, Leon. What do you have to say?
Yeah. Well, Corbin's funny, but I led the discussion on James Joyce in the book you guys were, was Finnegan and Wake.
Yes, James Joyce. Do you mean the book by Don Thiel or the book Finnegan's Wake?
Finnegan's Wake, because I never read the book or Don Thiel's books, but what you guys were discussing was pretty
interesting.
Or helped like bring actually interesting, but bring some new interesting patterns to like how I perceive the Finnegan's Wake book and how James Joyce
good
grading.
Yeah, the title of Don Thiel's main work is called Beyond the Word, and he's showing that, as Ted Carpenter pointed out last week or the week before, that verbal language, print-derived language, writing-derived language was obsolesced by the electric media, 100 years ago. And the artists and the real scientists, the artists, the small s scientists, started to look at the ramifications of that, whereas the capital S scientists, the professional ones, just tried to make more and more technologies to retrieve values that they started with 200 years before. And that was a futile cause, and end up blowing up many countries with their atomic bombs and stuff. So this is the percept. Beyond the word is the meaning of the arts. And Ted Carpenter lays this out. 100 years ago, all the arts and sciences unwittingly or consciously went into post-verbal realms. The
Yeah.
tactile, the invisible. And that's a vast generalization. Go ahead.
Yeah, and like how the Finnegan Wake pointed that out a little bit, like how the Dublin went more of what, Homer, kind of Homerish, whereas
Homeric.
There we go. Thank you.
Yeah.
But in that sensibility of like it's more oral than actual like literacy.
That's right. Now like, Brian, here's a young person. This young person never heard these ideas before, and of course it's. His intuition about it is very young and naive and whatever, but it's interesting how it's a new idea for him. You know, it attracts him. Do you have any comment on that?
Do I have any comment
on
it?
Yeah, on Leon's being inspired by our pointing out the oral nature of avant-garde literacy.
Right, yeah. I guess that is really the point where it comes down, where it really comes down to it with McLuhan of how valuable McLuhan is not just these patterns that he points out, but it actually comes down to just a mysterious process of just what resonates with people, what is the bias of the time, you know?
Yeah.
Like what is the kind of thing that gets people interested. Like, it's not just that the paradigm shift in science or whatever, it's not just composed of a bunch of discoveries. It's a bunch of discoveries that get talked about by people who find them very interesting. And, you know, this idea that this kind of blurring of the boundaries becomes the very interesting topic, the diagnosing of where that comes from. Why is it that in the 20th century, and particularly in the later 20th century, does the whole philosophical subject of things like zombies and viruses that are in a kind of an in-between state, why is it that things that are in an in-between state become so, why do they seem to communicate so much? Why are they so interesting to people?
Okay, I got that. Bring someone in here. Beverly, you want to get in here and say something so that you can have the access to Ian when Ian's here? You want to say something, Beverly? 847-869? You're sitting here. You have nothing to say, Beverly?
I'm here, sorry. I was just trying to figure out how to unmute. I just joined.
Doesn't matter.
Stuff on what's going on.
What? You heard. You've been here for 5 minutes. What is, comment on what you've heard.
It's really hard for me to comment on this kind of stuff. It just goes over my head.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it goes over your head. We're not interested in judging the level of your head. What ideas or notions do you get as you hear these words? What do you think, you know, what images come to you?
Beverly, you could just ask Bob, what are you talking about?
No, that's not good enough. You must do input. Beverly wants to talk to Ion, and I told her in a private email, you got to talk to me or the people around before Ion to get the message of Ion. Ion is only going to tell you, no matter what your health problem is, that you got to learn to talk. That's the answer. You got to learn to free up your mind and not be subject to every information that's coming at you and making you react, and most citizens end up dumbfounded and can't react. They haven't been able to react for 30 years because they don't have the language. So if you're going to enhance your awareness, this is the Ionic Agenda, so you got to start practicing. And we're not judging what you say. Just start using your mouth.
Well, I understand the significance of it. I just have a hard time taking it somewhere with my own words.
Well, are you saying you don't get any images in your mind when you hear Brian talk about Homer or radio, TV, different environments? You don't have any images? The words fall dead in your brain?
It kind of does. You know, I get images at the moment, but then it's just gone.
that's the fate of most people today, because so many images are happening to them.
Yeah.
So what images do you get right now? Make a declaring statement.
About anything or about what you guys are talking
about? Anything. Any images that,
Well, something I was wondering was when the water, the Venice Living Water, is that? No, what's it called?
The Living Water.
The Living Water. Are we going to be buying bottles of water from you, or?
Yep.
Bottles
of water.
Okay.
Bottles of water.
Bottles of water. You're going to be shipping water.
Yes.
Okay. Is there going to be a recommendation how much water we should buy a month, or how
does it work? No, I think one bottle will do for a while. Right, Carol? Carol doesn't know. Carol's the remaining mom, but I know. Carol's very careful. She's a professional. You know, they protect their expertise. I'm not. I'm free. I'm liberated. I can talk about anything. I inspire millions. Carol can only inspire patients. So, and that's what you are. You're a patient. But I'll just take a break here. I'll let you recover from saying a few words. And we'll go to 208-918. Do you have anything to say? From Idaho. Maybe it's Trina.
It's Denny.
Denny, you never have anything to say, so.
Oh, yeah. We can always conjure up something, even if it's wrong. So,
you should know, even listening for years, there's no wrong here. It's just inaccurate or inadequate, imprecise.
Okay, I can conjure up something if it's inaccurate or inadequate. So when he was talking about Ulysses, the first thing that I thought of, well, James Joyce was writing this back when maybe the automobile was just coming out, and you said he tried to start a group of theaters, movie theaters, pretty young at the time, but you were trying to point out, yes, he did think about technology. Back then, technology was pretty raw compared to what it is now.
Yes.
Okay, that was my statement.
Okay, well, what do you mean by raw?
That's what came to my mind.
Yeah, what you would say by raw is it was more hardware and mechanical and not organic. Once you had the electric media coming in, McLuhan called them more organic. They were extensions of the central nervous system, whereas the car and that are extension of your outer faculties, like your feet, with a little bit of electricity thrown in. But Joyce first wrote about the effect of the car in The Dubliners. One of the stories is about this hot guy who's doing car races. So he was looking at the car in his earlier stories. Then he looked in the software media, like the movie and radio, in his later books. So, Brian, do you have something inspired to say there? I don't want to leave you out. I want to keep you in here.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it just all comes down to the sort of special, the idea of the special intuition and the artist not only being able to finagle words into an impressive sequence or something, but that they've got a more general comprehension. I mean, if you're an artist and all you can do is finagle words into an impressive sequence, then you're not really enough of an artist. You know, it's all the the genius or the real artistic intuition, it's all the same thing, and it's not separated from the kind of intuition that sees, like, oh, this technological development is really going somewhere. I mean, I guess that kind of ties into the idea of kind of some more modern idea of where people get bored with this obsolete idea of the artist, and they see, like, investment bankers as being more interesting artists, or someone like a Steve Jobs is more of seen as more of an artist than people who create art, you know, because he saw the future coming or helped.
Well, he made technologies that affected people. I think one of his main platitudes, Ayn says, relax and allow, but people forget that allow, Ayn says, means to think. So you don't have to be making anything once you get into the 20th century in the third Copernican revolution of pattern recognition. You don't have to be making anything, being an artist per se. Many artists, Don Thiel says, were unconscious of what was going on, even though they kind of caught the radical modernist style. They couldn't talk about it. What's interesting is the ones who can talk about what they're doing. That's moving towards Gurdjieff's objective art. And so a thinker doesn't have to make a painting or a music piece. And a lot of the thinkers would end up in criticism, you know, maybe be critics in that. And that's an important part of art that people, of the art conversation that people aren't familiar with. And that's what I'm getting you're saying. The thinking, the perceiving and the thinking is important, no matter what medium you use, especially when you get into corporate media like radio, movies, and automobiles, where the individual is puny compared to their effects.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and this has it has a lot to do with this kind of debased idea of the artist as being just an expressor of emotions or a channel of their own emotions. That type of artist is less likely to have really any critical facility for talking about other people's art or talking about the meaning of art, and it's almost celebrated when you get artists who, like, have nothing to say about their art or can't say anything about their art. Like, it's a mystery to me. I don't know. It comes out. Like, this genre or this mode is the only thing I can do anything in. I can't translate it into something else. I have no synesthesia between that and other forms of other things. And I mean, I don't mean to knock people who are only good at one type of art. It's just more this idea of, like, what's celebrated by the culture at large of the idea of what is art. Well, it's someone who is, you know, half retarded and can only basically this idea of a kind of an idiot savant. It's a very idiot savant idea of art, where someone who has a mysterious talent for something they can't
almost
explain.
A channeler.
Yeah, it comes from we can't explain where it comes from. It has nothing to do with any kind of erudition or whatever Lacroix was talking about.
Okay, Brian, let me say this. When you talk about the romantic image, that comes, or the emotional image, that comes in with the romantic artists, the first wave of romantic artists, who were reacting to the cold, hard world of Newtonian science and the new industries, the new terrible towns and cities. So they got emotional, ran out to nature for a bomb, a BALM. And then
mostly steam engine. That would be mostly steam power at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, 50 years later, 1850, you get Baudelaire saying, no point running out to nature. I'm stuck with this city. This city's going to continue growing, the city of Paris. I better start looking at what's in here. And he became quite radical because he was not using emotion to gauge his perceptions of what's going on. So he created what's called the beginning of the symbolist poetry, and more abstract or not emotionally locatable, what he was talking about. Most people thought he was deranged on drugs or something, but they began to use the collage effect and not a linear statement of a feeling. And then you have Joyce and what I call the radical vorticists. They recognize that even making art is obsolete, and they're trying to figure out how to retrieve art, the older Gutenberg arts, in relation to a scene that Baudelaire was correct intuiting the sublime monster of it. So the emotional part, that's what they used to teach in school. Probably not now, but for the baby boomers, they were stuck with the romantic image that Brian's talking about. 100 years behind what was actually going along in the arts. And they couldn't even teach Ulysses back then because it was banned and locked up in the University of Toronto Library. So that's in the 40s and 50s. So anyways, what's interesting, Brian, is that many people like Sarah, who's welcome to speak, I haven't muted her, little Sarah, they're welcome to talk about their understanding of art. They don't go with the emotion anymore. What McLuhan's talking about, that the vortices came across, is no ordinary awareness among anybody having pretensions for creativity today. They are imagining they're creating effects.
Yeah.
And what was it that, Brian, you just said something earlier about quantum physics should be renamed the study of electricity? Is that?
Electric physics. Because it was concepts that came out of using electrical instruments, whereas science before electricity were using dull instruments, light on instruments. Right, Brian?
Yeah.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah, yeah. That it's basic. That the whole paradigm is just to illuminate the McLuhan side of things, just to notice that everything that we call quantum physics is, it's not just a simple continuation of science, of we were getting ever more closer to the truth, or in some kind of linear progression, that we totally shifted modes and started using electric tools to investigate nature and matter, and then these are the results that came out of it.
Yeah, it showed a different landscape, and then people tried to make rules about that, or patterns in relation to Newton, and that's what Einstein was suffering from, the effect of the telegraph, and realized that the simple absolutes of time and space that Newton was dealing with didn't apply anymore. Just the simple fact that you could be on a telephone and be in another space at the same time, that's going to screw up a literate view of time and space as absolutes. Right there, just the experience of being on the phone.
Yeah, Einstein, I was reminded lately that Einstein, he used the word spooky or spukhaft or something in German to disdain. He still, Einstein was like the bold radical of looking into the new era, but he still had very classical kind of biases about things, and why he didn't like the idea of quantum entanglement, which, of course, is a very radical idea, that once a couple of particles have come into contact with each other, that even when they move very far apart in the future, that if you do something to one of those particles, then the kind of opposite or parallel thing will immediately happen to the other particle, no matter how far away it is, and it'll happen instantly. And so Einstein derided that as spooky action at a distance, and thought, like, no, we need to, there's no way that's real. We need to come up with some other explanation for that.
And here's Joyce at that
everything
time.
Has to move through the medium,
And, yeah, and Brian, that's the Copenhagen Conference is 1927, and Einstein's prominent in Weimar, Germany. And you've got Joyce writing a page of Finnegan's Wake and publishing it in journals, and that looks like his pages look like quantum entanglement. He's betraying it right in his page. Now, I want to bring in two people. Bring in Mark and Roxana and see if they have anything to add. And there's also maybe someone else. Is Roxy or Mark have anything to say?
Yeah, I do.
Hi.
Yes,
okay.
Do.
Hey, Roxy. Roxy, Mark usually blows his wad pretty quickly, so let's hear what Mark has to say.
Yeah.
First, go ahead, Mark.
Roxana, your music and your videos are precious.
Exquisite.
No, precious.
Precious? Okay, that's close to exquisite.
So
who cares?
Yeah.
Yes. What did you say, Roxy?
Who cares?
Who cares? That's right. Who cares? It's in the moment here. Watch it. You're among the tough people, Mark. Excellent response. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, the guitar player, Joe Perry from Aerosmith, his autobiography, and Keith Richards, the autobiography for the Rolling Stones guitar player. What's fascinating about this
is that they, in 1957 and 1962, they took in the black musicians. We have Chuck Berry, Jimmy Reed, and Bo Diddley, and Little Richard, and the ultimate Robert Johnson, went to England and do their media of the radio enhanced and took in this environment of blues. And then they had the stalwarts who were totally blues and said, if you weren't black and you didn't wear breeches, we're not going to listen to you. So you had this aristocracy here that was blues. You had the Rolling Stones who were monks. You had to live in poverty. You had to practice. You had to listen to your records. And then you could only lay a woman if they came into the house. If you laid a woman outside the house, you were banned. So,
okay, now, Mark, just to get this clarified, you're saying the rule. This was the rules among Giorgio Gobelski's crowd in London? Or who's laying down these rules?
Yeah, well, it was the Stones. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts. There's different folks here, but my point is...
Yeah, but what? You're saying those... See, you're not being clear. Who's making these rules? Mick and them? Rules for themselves?
Oh, the band.
What's it got to do with Bo Diddley?
The band of Rolling Stones made these rules. The analogy is with you. I want to get back to that. So what happened is that, like Joe Perry, these rock guitar players learned from the people in London who lived in America and picked up on all of this music that came from America, from the black side of America, and incorporated it into rock and roll. And the only analogy that I want to make is that you have a constant motif that is like a musical structure in language that is as difficult to learn as it is for Keith Richards to learn from certain players. He talks about that in his book. They're mistakes. They're not part of the music. They're not part of the theory. They're not part of anything. They're a sound. They're an image. And Chuck Berry had it. Jimmy Reed had it.
Little Richards.
Yeah, absolutely. They had these things. Oh, and Robert Johnson, who was a one-man orchestra. These are secrets that break every system of all the music, which what you do. And so when you berate us and beat us up like any other conductor would, I used to have a conductor, a teacher in sixth grade that would break off batons. We have to duck because they would slice that way. You know, it was like ridiculous.
Yes.
And if you've got this compendium here that is so difficult, and all I can think is that Ion's the musical instrument and that you are the orchestrator through Zappa and all of your mixtures and stuff, and we're following this very complex score where we don't barely understand the notes, we barely understand the meter because we're very
right, correct.
And it's fucked up, dude.
That's not the appropriate conclusion. So Ion is here, and we can begin to talk about it. Roxy, did you want to comment on what Brian was saying or anything that was said before we go to Ion?
Well, about the art and the new technologies, how Joyce was already saying everybody's coming. And everybody is now an artist, and now we are forced to be an artist, like you said, and people like Boris Groys are saying.
Yeah.
You don't have to be really a good artist or inspired, a special artist like in this archetype of the 19th century.
Right.
Everybody's creating and... And the thing, I think, the thing is, like McLuhan said, not everybody's living in their time, and very few are aware of the new environments and the new technologies. And that's...
I would say, hey, Roxy, let me just add this point, what you're saying. Everybody is wants to express themselves and communicate. And Don Thiel's pointing out the thinkers who were developing theories about communication. Most of your friends there in Berlin are trying to communicate and get attention and communicate something. They don't get the meta level of what is the act of communication. What would you communicate? There may not be thinking that. Maybe some of the Derridas are. But it's just people have spaces now to express themselves in any medium. So we've got an orgy of expression, or what I call producer mania. And that's not in any environment to the way you respect art, is it?
No, because it's also a lot of remixing of things that were already done, like Baudelaire was doing with his collages of poetry.
Yeah.
Now we have all the images and the acoustic that was already made, and it's just a remix. But it's not a new pattern. It's not...
Right. Well, we know the new pattern is Iandom, and... Iandom is not easily understood. What Mark was referring to is the satellite conductors, Zappa, LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, myself, and other people, other archetypal performers, are satellite conductors in the global theater. But that's been usurped by Iandom. And you as an artist, Mark, are attracted to Iandom, but you're not sure how to articulate what it means to you, which is okay. Good that you expressed it honestly.
And also, I think this not being aware of the new technology, which is ION, leads people to false premises. I was hearing today in the morning some scientists talking about cryonics.
Yeah.
And how the process of that is just a process, and they can stop it by frozen people. But they said this process, it will be better if they stop it when they're still alive, if they could frozen people before they die. Because once this disconnection happens, they say, okay, we know how to frozen these people and preserve them, but we don't really know how to reanimate them. And they don't know when this technology is going to be there. And people are saving money and paying, and they have to have all the time the procedure they have to be that has to be undertaken when they die.
Yeah.
So they're thinking all the time that they're going to die, but they actually want to be eternal. But they because they don't know the new technologies, but they think that's the newest, that's the latest, that's the best. They fall into these false premises, and I wonder why, well, not why, but so brilliant people are so disconnected, and instead of finding ION, they, for example, spend so much money in trying to preserve their bodies so that they can be eternal someday when there is the technology to reanimate them, instead of taking the new drops and changing their blood.
Right.
And
continue. Yeah. And?
Yeah, that's happening also with artists and scientists
that
are not aware of ION.
Right. Now, we're going to bring in ION to address this because we said, yes, let's have ION talk about cryonics. But just before, I just want to see who the 310 is. 310-625, you want to identify yourself?
Pamela Wheeler.
Pamela Wheeler. Pam?
Yes.
Pam, I know.
Yes, Pam,
you. Oh, how you doing, Pam? Very good. Okay, we'll let you listen for a bit here. We're going to bring you an eye on right now. And
okay.
We've got, when you see openings, you speak and you address eye. Now, Beverly has a medical question. But before we go to Beverly, let's address eye on. And do you have a way of answering Roxana's question about cryonics, ION? Welcome aboard.
Post-coital thinness, degenipian, emphatic eternity.
That's a good phrase. Post-mortem Synesthesia, manipiantphatic eternity. Postcoital. Synesthesic.
Manipiantphatic
eternity. Well, that's pretty good, Brian. What do you think of that, Brian? It's a pretty good juxtaposition of terms there. It means much to me. I don't think it means anything to Pam Wheeler, but what do you see, Brian?
Pam Wheeler and her coffee enemas. We love her.
Does she do that, Carol? Pam and her coffee enemas. Yes. So, Brian, do you have anything to say about those sequence of words?
Manipiantphatic eternity sounds like a good way to make fun of the cryonic pretension.
Yeah.
The kind of idea. Yeah, I mean, that
there's no pretension. They're serious. They're really freezing people.
Oh yeah, they're very serious for sure, and they have to be serious that they're going to open the wallets to pay for it. But the pretension that you're going to freeze a body and by keeping all the structure there that you're somehow going to be able to get it moving by.
But the thing is, they're only concentrated on the physical body, and they're not aware of all the other bodies and non-physical. And I always wonder, what are the factors that
Isn't that the same thing as a snapshot? Wouldn't a Kodak be an example of cryogenics?
No. Far from it, Ion.
Why?
The photograph. Are you saying they're working with a photographic image of themselves?
No.
Well, you frozen yourself
in time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So frozen in time is the photograph. Before the photograph, and McLuhan wrote about this, people would not imagine themselves frozen in time. So you're right, it isn't the effect of the photograph.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the manipiantphatic response.
Well, by the guys who run the cryonics industry, or it's a response by who? By the
There wouldn't
the
be
outside?
A cryonics industry if the people weren't buying it. There wouldn't be one.
Right. So is the people, the ones who are buying it, they're the manipiantphatic eternal seekers?
Post-coitally, yes.
Ah, okay. So he described the customer base there, everybody. Post-coital synesthetic. Yeah, go ahead.
What are the factors that disconnect the scientists? They're so brilliant, but they are not into Ion Dome.
Well, we don't know what you mean. Just because they don't call, just because they're so brilliant that they're not smart doesn't mean they're stupid. They're just a little slow.
You're pretty fast, Roxy. They're slow.
Yes, but I think there is a part of people that is aware that we're eternal. Instead of finding you.
Hold on. Why do you prepare forever? If you're not eternal, why do you prepare forever? Why do you live? Everything you do, it has to do with tomorrow. If there's not eternity, why live for tomorrow? Why take care of yourself today? If it's just today, if there's only now, then forget the rest of it. It'll take care of itself. Then there'll be a tomorrow if there's a tomorrow, but you won't be worried about it because you're busy doing today. If every breath you took was like your last, you wouldn't care about your next.
Yeah, but she's talking about people who don't think that way, Ion.
Well, who are those?
They're the ones who think there is a future. They're not engaged in the now, like you just described.
Well, I understand it, but that's the point. She says that they don't believe in eternity. Everyone does, or they wouldn't make the choices that they make. Every step they're making is an eternal choice, and they know it.
Ah, so you're saying people are pretending. So those ones that are responding to the industry, to the potential, are being satirists, manipiantphatic satirists, and say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. Freeze me up, buddy.
Yeah, you could, but I mean, it's like the next last famous diet pill, same way.
Okay, so there it is, Roxy. Let's not get too worked up about it. It's just another fad, and there's always people ready to engage in fads as a manipiantphatic postcoital response.
And then eternity. If they're trying to save some money, if they don't have any Cambio, if you're brilliant enough that you want yourself frozen for all the time, you ought to have enough money to do it. Sometimes they're just freezing the head. It makes it easier.
Yes.
They cut the head off and just freezing the head. If you don't have enough money to freeze your whole body, you're probably not going to have enough money when they reanimate you to be able to function either. So there you go.
Yes, yes, they were also saying that they don't know how to connect all the nerves, but they hope some people will. But there is a disconnection. I always wonder, these artists and these scientists, is it that they don't recognize the non-physical? That
bilateral synaptic conjunction.
Trilateral?
Bilateral.
Synaptic conjunction. Bilateral. Synaptic. And I have to write the notes.
Is that like neurons that fire together, wire together, so their brains are a little different?
We don't dislike what you mean. We just don't have a clue what you're trying to say.
Never let me down, Ion. Never.
Okay, so you have anything to further say there, Sarah, about that?
Well, I just,
the mind's
a bilateral conjunction.
The mind's a little different.
Right,
we're
a bilateral.
We're not talking about movement in the brain. We're talking about movement in the body.
Okay, and so then bilateral means either half of, both halves of the body?
Both sides, yes.
Oh, both sides. Okay, thank you.
Hey, Brian, you recognize, Ian did a very good perception there. The McClellan writes about how Freud and the certain kind of thinking that came in, Thiel talks about it 100 years ago, a little bit longer than that, is the photograph made people see, and Ted Carpenter talks about it in his speech last week or the week before, the photograph made people see things in themselves they never saw before. They never noticed that they had that kind of precise, high-definition body.
Yeah.
So Ian's made a good point. People are frozen with the 19th century media images, and that's what they think that's called materialism, or not noticing the non-physical. But Ian says that there's no difference between the ascended and the little man today, because everybody knows they're eternal, but they don't necessarily want to operate with that principle consciously.
Yes, or they're operating in these false premises. There's also another cryonic school, the Russians, under transhumanism, they think they can download somehow the what you are.
Right.
And this software to imbue it maybe just with the head in that sort of robot.
Prescribed consciousness, where it basically takes a CD of you and does the mapping of you so that they can know who you are, so you'll know who you are. It'd be great. It's the same thing they do with the CAT scan now. They take cross-sections of you to look at
right.
you, so you can see you on the body.
And that's an example of technology numbing you.
Of the recording, like the frozen Kodak moment of your whole soul, which they think they can retrieve and have in some sort of format. But I always wonder what are the factors that disconnect people from non-physical and they don't recognize it. Also,
it's a simple answer. That's their choice. It's a simple choice because they're so powerful.
There is no disconnection. We don't see them as disconnected.
They're not disconnected, Roxy. Now, there's a shocking response.
They're not. They're absolutely connected. It's just like the blender. The blender's still the blender whether you're using it or not.
Yeah, they're not disconnected. But they're acting in a way to look like they're not interested in certain ways of expressing themselves.
But they're not recognizing the non-physical. And I think that's
the information you're using to describe it is to say that. They most certainly are.
Are you going to retreat, Roxy, for a minute?
Yes, but that's the thing. So little people are engaging in Ayandam, and I mean, there are so many, many, many humans. And
well, I would say a lot of people are engaging in Ayandam by default.
Okay.
Would you say that, Ayan?
Well, of course we would.